is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, March 20th, 2020. I'm Buster Olney in my home studio. Taylor Schwenk is producing from his home studio. Taylor, you know the times that we're in when your whole day today revolves around a leisurely drive.
Oh my God. I didn't know what you were going to bring up here, but yeah, we were trying to arrange an interview for later or this weekend. And, I haven't left the house since last Saturday. And my wife is like, we just got to go for a drive. We got to get out and do something. We might, get some carry out. A lot of these breweries around here are offering like pay ahead and we will set a bunch of beer by your car for you to grab. So we might do that as like our Friday night fun. But yeah, that's about it. So we had to big time someone who is very big time and, push him back a little bit. So I appreciate you doing that, Buster. And yeah, that's the state of things right now.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that, the identity of that person, what he's going to join us to talk about later in the podcast. You mentioned them leaving the beer outside your car. I have great neighbors here where I live, and a couple of friends that we've known for 20 years. And the other day, my wife and I were hoping to have a bottle of wine. And then normally we didn't have any in the house, so I was going to call them. And then the whole conversation became about, okay, why don't you leave it on the porch so we don't actually have to have contact with each other? And so I just waved at him through the window when I went to get the bottle. That's what we're doing right now, for sure.
You know what you could do? I've heard this is probably going to become popular as the weather gets nicer. You guys could have an outdoor little get together, but you just have to stay, probably at least 6 feet. I would err closer to 10 or 12 feet, but you hang out in your driveway. They hang out, on the sidewalk or something. You get some lawn chairs and I think that'll work. I'm definitely going to explore that. I don't know my neighbors, but, maybe having some friends over and, hanging out in the driveway. We'll be in the garage. They hang out in the driveway and we'll be good. We'll get our social interaction, but be responsible about it.
We've actually got a great place for that. We got a fire pit out in the back. And so we can, we have this stone wall. We can sit on opposite sides, no more than 12 feet close to each other. So,
oh, nice.
That'll be good.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Today we have a great conversation with David Wells, Boomer, who is a member of the 98 Yankees, arguably the greatest team in history. I first covered Boomer in 1996 when I was at the Baltimore Sun. He was part of the Baltimore Orioles. And again, in 98, when I was at the New York Times, they covered the Yankees. He is a great storyteller with a remarkable background. I think the most enjoyable conversation I ever had with David Wells, he has just a crazy background. And I asked him, I said, hey, what was the craziest thing that you ever did as a kid? And he kind of paused. He goes, well, I blew up a car once. That's David Wells, okay? That's his personality. He's got great stories from the 98 season describing the loudest punch he's ever heard and Angry Joe Torre, and, of course, a 24-hour period for him that included a Saturday Night Live after party, Jimmy Fallon, Lorne Michaels, and a perfect game. But before we get to that, some news and notes. Red Sox ace Chris Sale is going to have Tommy John surgery. He talked to sources involved in this decision last night, and basically they said, first off, his elbow needed to be fixed. And two, they wanted to make this decision sooner rather than later, because the sooner that he has it, the better the chances are that he's going to be able to pitch in 2021, because typically Tommy John surgery takes about 12 to 14 months for healing and rehabilitation. So he could be pitching again for the Red Sox in spring of 21. The Giants' Tyler Beede is also going to have Tommy John surgery. Rockies manager Bud Black was on a conference call yesterday, and he said he's open to doubleheaders when Major League Baseball returns. His quote was, in theory, yeah, I think all of us would be up for some sort of doubleheader situation. The thing that's going to be in front of all of us is it's going to be the same for everybody. It's got to make sense for the clubs and the players. And finally, Major League Baseball announced yesterday that it will provide some funding to minor leaguers who make little money to begin with, and now have seen their livelihood shut down. Before we get to David Wells, support for Baseball Tonight comes from the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card. With the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card, you'll earn unlimited 5% back at Walmart online. That's 5% back at Walmart online when you grab new shades for your beach trip, new boots for your hiking trip, or noise-canceling headphones when you need some vacation me time. You'll also earn 2% at Walmart stores, restaurants, and travel, and 1% everywhere else. When you want all that, you need the Capital One Walmart Rewards Card. What's in your wallet? Terms and exclusions apply. Capital One N.A. David Wells pitched 21 years in the big leagues. He won 239 games. And, of course, he's famous for throwing a perfect game in 1998. Boomer, it's great to talk with you.
It's been a long time. Good talking with you.
Good talking with you, too. Hey, thanks for filling in as we, wait through this time where we are just dying for baseball conversation.
I would bet, man. Everybody's dying for something.
Exactly. I wanted to ask you, you've got a lot of stories from a lot of parts of your career, but I wanted to talk about the team generally regarded as the best in history, the 1998 Yankees. You know, the greatest team of all time, 125 wins. What generally pops to mind for you when you first someone mentions the 98 Yankees?
Well, I remember, I think we went 0-4 to start the season, and Joe Torre got pissed. So we had a team meeting. Not too many guys were very happy with it, but you know, it was a great motivating, you know, I guess speech, as you would say, because what happened after that really solidified that season, and it struck a nerve with a lot of guys, and we went on a rampage.
Yeah, and so what I remember about that is that meeting was in Seattle, if I recall correctly, and there was something about. You know, the starting pitchers not protecting the hitters, and that spurred into a larger talk.
Yeah, it did. I mean, you know, and back then it was, you know, it was hit and miss with that kind of stuff, you know, with guys hitting one another. Because when I was told to hit somebody, it was hard. I can hit them without, you know, subconsciously I just drill somebody because I always had good command behind them. I threw it in front of them, over them. And I missed him, and Cito wanted to fight. He was so pissed off at me because I missed him. and it's not like I didn't try, but, you know, I think that was the first and only time that I was ever told, because it got out of hand pretty bad. And, you know, so that from that point on, you know, some guys had a problem with it. Some guys didn't, you know, but, you know, nowadays it's, you get thrown out of the game or you get warned if you come up and in. But, yeah, but when that happened up there, it was, you know, we're all just scratching our heads going, you know, what the hell? Because, you know, you didn't want to get thrown out of a game, obviously. So I would always, so my rule of thumb was I just went to somebody, you know, unless it was so blatant, I would just go up to him and say, should I or shouldn't I? I'd go right up to the hitter. Want me to get this next guy? And my rule of thumb is just hit the next guy, just to defuse it.
Yeah, and Boomer, my sense in covering you was that you were sort of a, like Andy Pettit didn't like doing it. He just didn't like the retaliation stuff. But you were just sort of like, it wasn't like you were aggressive like Roger Clemens was aggressive. Like he had no problem throwing at guys. But I never got the sense that it was something that you actually enjoyed doing. You just felt it was part of the job.
No, it was. And you look at my bubblegum card, you don't see me hit by pitch. You don't see a whole lot of them. You know, I really didn't hit a whole lot of guys because, you know, it was just, you know, I picked and choose when I had to. You know, if a guy showboated me, I'd drill him. The next at bat, he'd get smoked. You know, protecting a guy. You know, I remember in the incidents with Baltimore with Benitez when he hit Tino. You know, I wasn't pitching that game, but that's one of those times where you go to town and, you know, and who cares what happens after that, because that guy was such a knucklehead, you know, at that time. So it was something that where you had to do that and go in and protecting and, you know, and a lot of guys, I tell you, you get a lot of respect and, you know, like you said, Andy, and that was some guys didn't like to do it. You know, Roger didn't mind. I didn't mind, but a lot of times when I was pitching, I didn't really have to because I always threw strikes. So there was really no need. And I remember one incident in Toronto when I was there, I think in 2000, and Sean Green, Carlos Delgado, a couple other guys got hit, and it was Doug Litton, and he was with Cleveland. And my rule of thumb was hit the first guy. Well, Albert Bell is the first guy. And I'm going, oh boy, here we go. You know, Doug Litton hit was hitting guys left and right. And Doug Litton played for the Blue Jays, and then he got traded. And so when I hit Albert Bell, I smoked him pretty good. And I was waiting for him to charge because everyone knew Albert Bell, man. That dude was crazy. And he wore it. He looked at me. He just put the bat down and he kind of walked towards first base. And I'm just waiting for him to charge at any time. And, you know, I was on pins and needles then. Next guy up, double play. And he was still looking at me. I turned around because I'm not keeping my back to him. I just make sure he was going into the dugout. He went right into the dugout and grabbed Doug Litton right by his throat. Started shaking him a little bit. But he was a student of the game, and he knew what was going on. And that was like one of those moments where I was like, I just dodged a bullet. I just dodged a brawl. And that's one brawl I didn't want to get in. But, you know, I was game. I was game for any brawl. I didn't care. But it's weird because I never got charged in my career.
So when did you get a sense that 98 team could be special, Boomer, as we move forward through that season?
Well, I think it was, you know, just after that meeting, we started gelling as a team. And, you know, it came pretty, you know, it was like a game within a game with ourselves, because with the pitching staff, we didn't want to be the one to lose that series. And we just kept going in and winning every series. And that just kind of started happening. I mean, we basically rolled over everybody. You know, the pitching was stellar. I think Coney won 20 games that year. I had 18. I think Pettit had like 16 or 17. You know, it was just one of those things, and all cylinders were going. And, you know, and I've never seen anything like it, you know, in my 21 years of playing. I've never been on a team that all the way through the playoffs into the World Series and sweeping the Padres. But, you know, it happened literally right after that, Buster. It was, you know, it was full steam ahead because everybody, I think, took it personal what Joe said to us in the meeting, and, you know, calling guys out, called Derek out a little bit, and Derek didn't like it. So it was, you know, but it was meant to be. It was a positive, you know, ass chewing, if you call it that. But, you know, Joe wasn't really big on yelling and screaming, but he would get his point across. And, you know, that's one good quality that Joe had as a manager, was getting guys to do what they had to do by calling them out.
You know, what jumped out at me about covering that team, Boomer, was that, and especially after, you know, now having covered baseball for 30 years, that besides the fact that that team had a lot of great players, was the unbelievable energy that it brought to the park every day. That's a hard thing to do. That is a hard thing to do, to play with that kind of energy day in and day out. And whether it was because, you know, the loss to Cleveland in the playoffs the year before, Joe's speech, the professionalism of the group, that team played hard.
You know, and that was the thing. If there was any animosity that was in the club, and this was behind closed doors, stuff that you guys never saw, but if anybody had anything against each other or whatever, it was literally nipped in the bud. Somebody would stand up. Somebody would get in the middle. You know, Joe left us alone. We had the clubhouse, and, you know, and it was just something like that we had to take care of our own. And that was the beauty of that team, is like you would never see anybody – you know, no, there was just no animosity. There might have been from time to time. I guess the only problem was me, because I went out all the time. and Joe was getting, and Joe, there was a few other guys that did as well, you know, a few of the relievers that, you know, a group of us that hung out a lot. But, you know, we just, when you're rolling like that, you go out, you're getting people recognizing you, you're iconic in the city. Because, you know, we were doing so well. You know, it happens when you're doing good. They all want to be there. They want to be your friends. They want to do that. But, you know, and then Joe was starting to get mad at me because I was going out all the time. But I just told him, I said, listen, do you want to win? Because you know me, I play my music every 5 days. And I have that clubhouse roaring, you know, with my music, with all the heavy metal, with Slipknot, Disturbed, Metallica. You know, all that stuff. And Joe would come in and turn it down. I'd go back and turn it back up. And I'm like, dude, I said, if you don't want to hear the music, Joe, go outside. You know, batting practice is going on. Why don't you go outside and do what you got to do? Leave me alone. I said, if you want to win, let the music go. And so we kind of butted heads there. And then David Cohn just said, you know, he went to Joe and says, Joe, I got him. Let me just take him and, you know, we'll be fine. Just leave him to me. And so Coney and I just, you know, we sailed off into the sunset with good numbers, both of us pitching, you know, and a lot of times we went out, you know, a lot, you know, the night before we pitched, have a couple of toddies, you know, relaxes you the next day. You're not all wound up, you know, you get nerves when you pitch, you know, but the butterflies. And, you know, you kind of calm them down that way. That was, at least that was our theory.
Yeah. And one of the times you went out was the night of May 16th, 1998. The next day, you're scheduled to pitch against the Twins. And Boomer, just at that time, because, of course, the story is well known that as you wrote in your book about being hungover when you come to the park on May 17th, but on a David Wells scale of 1 to 10, how hungover were you that morning?
10. Yeah, it got pretty ugly that night. You know, Jimmy Fallon and I went to the after party, and I did not want to go. I literally did not want to go. But Marcy Klein, she started egging me on, and I'm like, all right, I'll just come for a moment, and then I'll slip on out. Well, it didn't happen because I got with the cast, with Jimmy and Seth, and I think Horatio Sands, Fred Armisen, all the guys, the cast, and, you know, with Lauren there as well. And just one thing led to another. And it was like 5:30, and Jimmy Fallon and I are going, all right, who's leaving first, you or me? And I'm like, well, you leave first. It was like, no, you leave first. So it was kind of one of those type of deals. And, you know, I lost all, you know, I just lost all senses. I forgot that I had to pitch the next day, basically, you know, and then I knew that it was like, oh crap, it's a 1 o'clock game. And just a couple hours of sleep. My son woke me up. Brandon, who was, you know, he was what, 4 years old, 5 years old at the time there. No, he was like 7 at the time. And it was like, I just was like, oh boy. And I got up, I just started drinking coffee. Coffee and water. And I stayed away from everybody when I got to the ballpark. I went in the back room. I said, Rohan, just work out my legs, because if anything's going to go first, it's your legs. So I said, just keep my legs in shape. And, you know, I was back and forth to the bathroom about 8 times. So it was one of those things. If I failed that day, I knew I was probably going to get fined and suspended. The shape that I was in when I got to the ballpark.
Wow. You hated day games. You hated pitching day games. And I've always, my theory has always been, you come from San Diego County where there's no humidity. And so a hot, humid afternoon on a, you know, given day, that was your least favorite thing to do. I always thought you were someone who hated day games.
You're 100% correct. You know, I would ask all the managers at teams. I say, hey, you know, avoid day games with me. I don't like day games. I don't fare well at being in the humidity and all that. And I wasn't used to it. I didn't like the humidity. You know, I always said fat people sweat. So, you know, it was one of those things that, I couldn't do it because I went out a lot. I mean, it was one of those things. I was an old school. I'm a throwback. Those guys went out every night. You know, I used to sit down with Whitey and Moose and Hank Bowell, Gator, you know, on Old Timers Day in the clubhouse. I would sit with these guys and they would just tell me unbelievable stories. And they're like, Boomer, you should have played when we did. You would have fit right in. You know, they were out every night tearing up the town. And that was me. That's just, you know, I lived for the old school baseball. It worked.
It certainly worked that day. You're rolling along against the Minnesota Twins. You have a no hitter. And as you know, there's that longstanding baseball superstition that no one's allowed to talk about a no hitter in progress. But you, of course, broke that rule. You going and finding David Cohn in the middle of the game because you were so kind of anxious and worked up about it.
Well, I went in, I think it was like the fourth inning. I went into the lounge, players lounge, to grab water because I was very superstitious. So I went in, I grabbed the water, and Michael Kay goes, Dave Wells got a perfect game. I'm like, la 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 la, and I ran out of there, got in the dugout, got in my seat, and then I don't know, it was like the sixth or seventh inning or something. I went down. I was just like, I felt alone. And I remember going to sit between Scott Brocious and Tino Martinez. And they both got up and walked away. And I'm like, wow, this is something, man. I'd walk in the dugout and guys would literally jump out of the way. They don't want to touch me. They don't want to get near me. And then David Cohn, he came down towards the end of the dugout where I sat all the time. And he was just like, he sat there. And then I just started chirping at him. And he started acknowledging me. And then he tells, I think it was like the eighth inning, he tells me to throw a knuckleball. I said, excuse me? And he goes, why don't you break out your knuckleball? I go, dude, I don't throw a knuckleball. And he goes, yeah, you do. And I'm like, dude, I'm not going to throw a knuckleball in a game like this. He goes, you show me nothing. Call me a... And I was just like, I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. But realizing, not at that moment, when I'm on the mound, I kind of looked in the dark. I'm like, and then I knew what he was trying to do. He was just trying to relax me. That's what he was trying to do. So he kind of broke the mold. I broke it a little bit first, and then as I'm walking off, he's screaming at me, call me again. I didn't throw it, but I didn't need to.
Unbelievable.
So the last pitch you throw, there's a fly ball hit to right field. Paul O'Neill catches it, and he goes crazy. You go crazy. Yankee Stadium goes crazy on Beanie Day. And what I thought was funny is in the clubhouse, from what I understood, Paul O'Neill had no idea. He only knew it was a no-hitter. Did you ever hear that story?
Yeah, and it was true. After all the hoopla, he's like, damn, dude, I didn't. And he told me, he goes, I didn't know it was a perfect game, because he did. It was
Tom Browning
from Cincinnati. Tom Browning's. Yeah, it was Tom Browning's one that he did. He goes, this is great. Now part of two perfect games, and then let alone did he know he's part of three of them, you know, the next year. So that was pretty cool that, you know, that he, that was that. You know, it's funny because Pat Mears was the last hitter. And 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I was in for a coaches convention. I think it was in Indianapolis. And I ran into him. He was at one of the booths there selling some type of product. Because I guess he was a coach or whatever. And they gave me the mound. They dug the mound up from Yankee Stadium, and then they painted it. And I had all the Twins sign it.
Wow.
And so I got Pat Mears' number. I just got to somehow get him the rubber. But I didn't have the Yankee sign. So I don't have anybody on the Yankees. I didn't have the team sign the mound, which I screwed up. But I can still get it because, you know, we're that line. Well, except for one guy, he's in prison. But, you know, it'd be hard to get. Take it to a prison and get Chad Curtis to sign it.
There you go. All right. So you throw the perfect game, and then 2 days later, you guys have, with the Baltimore Orioles, the worst baseball fight that I ever saw. You mentioned Armando Benitez. He gives up a home run to Bernie Williams, and then Tino Martinez is coming up next, and Armando drills him right in the back, and it just so happened that in 1995, Armando had hit Tino while Tino was with Seattle under similar circumstances, and a fight breaks out. And not only is there a fight, but it spills over into the Orioles dugout. What do you remember about that?
Oh my God. It was bad. I mean, and I remember we were over there and we're literally in the dugout, and I just hear this big old, like this pop. It was the loudest punch I've ever heard. And Alan Mills punched Daryl Strawberry right in the, and it was just like my head turned because it was so loud. And Daryl just looked at him and I go, oh boy. And Mills, you know, he was black belt in karate. So he was, you know, he had fighting skills. And I was like, oh my God, Mills is going to die. And so Daryl just took it like, I mean, I've never seen it play. It was like, I think when Marvin Hagler hit
Tommy Hearns
in a fight. It was an insane fight, and he hit he hit him so hard. It was kind of like that, because I saw that fight, and he didn't budge. He just took it and went after him, and then a lot of guys got in between him. Well, I'm down in the dugout. I'm down halfway down the dugout, and I got Benito and the scissors. I'm sitting literally on the bench. I got my legs around his midsection, and I got him around the neck. And he's screaming, "Boomer, let me go," because I was teammates with him the year before or 2 years before. And it was like, "You got to be kidding me." And I'm not letting this go, and I'm trying to choke him out because he's going nowhere. He's going nowhere. And all I see is Graham Lloyd and Nelson, the Twin Towers, come just throwing haymakers everywhere. It was one of the best brawls I've ever been a part of. It was awesome.
It was crazy, and it's funny. I've never heard that description. I covered the Orioles, and Alan Mills was always one of those guys who was the nicest person you'd meet, and it was like Clark Kent turning into Superman when a fight broke out.
Oh, no doubt. And you know, and I was good friends with Millsy, and you know, but he was mild mannered. He just give you the shirt off his back. But you know, when you're in a situation like that, you know. You look at him, he wasn't that small of a guy, but he went after the biggest guy on the team, and that was Daryl Strawberry.
Yeah, who went after Armando Benitez after he was one of the first players to come out of the dugout to go after him and after he hit Tino. I wanted to ask you about, as that season was going along, I remember in spring training of that year, Chuck, there was a ground ball to Chuck Knobloch, and he threw the ball away, and it was kind of like, huh, what was that? And then that continued to manifest as that season went along. What do you remember about when that first popped up?
It was the Steve Sachs syndrome. It was unbelievable because he just, and I think it was Mackie Sasser from the Mets couldn't put back to the pitcher.
Yep.
So when that started happening, it was just like, why do you think Jorge Posada or whoever was catching, you know, when the ground ball was hit the second, they stopped right there, like in right by the dugout, make sure the ball didn't go. So that was just kind of like, you know, you never know when you're going to have a gem of a game. And when Ron Coomer hit that ball, he hit it so hard to Knobloch. I thought it hit him in the chest, one hop. I didn't even think he got a glove on it, but he did. But, it was hit so hard, and Knobloch got it. And then all of a sudden I go, oh, boy, he's got a throw. And he threw a strike. He threw a strike right to Tino, and I was just like, what the heck? But when you see that, I mean, that can really, you know, when a guy throws a ball away like that, it can really change your mindset as a pitcher. Because then you're going to go, hey, Joe, you know, find somebody else, put somebody else in there, and, you know, put Homer in there, you know, put Homer Bush a second, put somebody there, because of the fact that when you get the yips like that, it changes the dynamics of the game. But he was such a good player, you know, you needed his bat.
Yeah, the other thing too is that it looked like he, when he had a reaction play like that play you described in your perfect game, that he was okay. It was the ones when he had even a little bit of time to think about it.
Yeah, you know, you just, some guys, the ball hit so hard, you got a couple seconds to throw it, and you just lose your subconscious and you just fling it. I don't know what Willie did with them or whatever it was, get rid of the ball as quick as you could, you know, when they're like taking ground balls or BP and stuff like that, or working with them. I would hope Willie would have done something with them like that. But, you know, when it's embedded in your head and you got a phobia, you know, it's really hard to overcome those types of things. But, you know, it wasn't one of those things that, you know, it happened. He got over it. But from time to time, he would launch it and you're just like, oh boy, but it could happen to anybody.
That's exactly right. And, you know, he was, it came and went that first year and got more pronounced as years went along. But that first year, his value to the team was so extraordinary as a leadoff hitter that, you know, the defense didn't matter as much. As you guys went along, you go into September, you're rolling, and I'll never forget this. It was a game in Baltimore, and I don't think I've ever talked to you about this. It was a game in Baltimore late in the year, and there was a pop-up, and you raised your arms out the side like, you know, can someone catch it? Because it fell among three guys, including Derek Jeter. And I had always heard a story about Derek talking to you after that moment. What do you remember about that?
You know what it was is that when it happened, you know, and I'm looking around, and I'm like, I think it was because he thought – he came to me because it was afterwards, and he said the media said that I showed him up. And then Derek popped off, I think, a little bit. And then I think that's how it was. I said, Derek, I said, no, I never showed anybody up out there. You know, I was an emotional guy anyways. But, you know, I'm like, Derek, this is all blown out of context because, you know, it was an easy it's an easy fly ball. Somebody's got to take charge. You should have took charge, you know, but it's not me being mad at you. It's just me throwing my arms like in disbelief. It's just a reaction. It wasn't me showing you up, you know, and that's where I had to diffuse it because, you know, if you showed anybody up on your team, especially an infielder, you know, here comes the Olays, you know, they could bobble, they could really screw you over. This happened. I mean, through baseball, the years of baseball, you know, a pitcher shows a guy up, easy ground ball, he boots it on purpose, you know, depending on, you know, the game situation. But that's one thing that you try to avoid at all times. So, like, if a guy made an error behind me or whatever in a crucial situation, I'd always turn around and say, hey, man, I got you. I'm going to get you a ground ball right here. You know, so I tried to help the situation.
So because you guys were so dominant in the regular season, you go into the postseason as heavy favorites, and you fall behind Cleveland 2-1, and Orlando Hernandez, El Duque, gets the ball in game 4 in Cleveland, and he wins. What do you remember about that game?
El Duque, I mean, he was a different breed. This guy didn't care about throwing it to any pitch at any given time. You know, how good he was and how fearless this guy was. I mean, he was like Derek in October. That's kind of how I put it with El Duque, because this guy just went out there. He loved the pitch. He had no fear. He would throw 3-2 curveballs, you know, 3-2 sliders, like Doc always did. But you know, to me, it was, you know, it was the perfect guy in the right situation, you know, to put us, you know, to put us in a good situation to keep us going. Because, you know, when you need to lean on somebody, and, you know, Andy Pettit's probably one of the best postseason pitchers I've ever seen in my life. But to have another guy like that, that you felt really comfortable on the mound. No, and Kirk Gibson always said, don't be afraid to fail. If you're afraid to fail, get out of the game, go do something else. Go bang nails, go flip burgers, do something, because this isn't the place for you. You know, your failures are your biggest assets. And I've taken that from 1993 when I was teammates with Kirk in Detroit. I've taken that all the way through the rest of my career. And today, when I speak corporate events or whatever, it's your failures are your biggest assets. And, you know, that's where I love to go on. And that was the best advice that Kirk Gibson, you know, ever gave me.
Yeah, what I remember about in that game, and you're exactly right that El Duque was like that, the Indians load the bases and Jim Thome's at the plate, and he threw him a changeup with a 3-2 count, and Thome swung through it. And then you learned afterward that it was a pitch that he had only really learned the grip on a month before. But that's El Duque's personality. Like, he had such a great feel for the ball.
No doubt. You know, no doubt. It was, you know, he was a breath of fresh air out there. And, you know, even though the language barrier for us is he didn't speak very good. He tried to, you know, we didn't know Spanish that well. But, you know, it was just one of those things that this kid, who is this guy? You know, he comes over from on a boat, and here he is in the big leagues, and he's pitched like he's been there his whole career. That's pretty amazing.
It really was. And of course, you guys sweep the Padres in the World Series, and you as a San Diego kid, what was it like to have that experience?
It sucked because I got booed in my own hometown. Because I remember game one, you know, about 2 home runs to Greg Bond and one to Tony Gwynn, and then Knobloch hit the home run, and then Tino hit the grand slam, you know. But prior to that game, the morning before game one, I went on Howard Stern, and Howard Stern was trying to get me to predict, you know, what we were going to win it in. I said, Howard, I'm not predicting anything. I said, it wouldn't be fair to the Padres. It wouldn't be fair to the Yankees or anybody else. I said, I'm not predicting anything. I just hope we win. And he would, you know, other question, he'd come right back to it. And I would avoid it. He'd come right back to it. And I go, Tower, just to shut you up, man. I said, if I was a bet man, I said, I would like to win it in 5. Said, because at least you get another gate, you know, for the purse. So I said, you know, I would like to win it in 5 games. Next day in the paper, Wells predicts 5. I believe in the Post or the Daily News, whatever it was. And I'm like, oh crap. I said, this is not good. Well, Dave Stewart took offense to it, and Dave told me, he goes, we took that article, but he posted it in it and just to motivate the Padres. Well, it motivated them, but we had Chuck Knobloch and Tino Martinez as well. I think I went like seven innings that way, but I was pissed because, you know, here I am. I just gave up like five runs, and after seven, I'm out. I'm like, there's no way we're going to win this game. I'm in the shower. I'm like, piss on it. I'm gonna shower. I'm from the media and all that. And I'm in the shower, and one of the clubhouse kids comes, Boomer, Chuck just tied the game up. I'm like, what? Out of the shower, I put all my clothes back on and went out into the dugout. And then Tino hits a grand slam, and I get the W. I'm like, how cool is that? It's pretty awesome. But and here I am, right, sucking my thumb, all pissed off, ready to, you know, like I said, get beat up by the media and then go have a couple cold ones and sulk and cry and, you know, and all that stuff. And, you know, and then that happens. And, you know, it's crazy. You know, the things they always say, where were you during this? Where were you? Well, I was in a damn shower when Chuck Knobloch hit the 3-run homer to tie the game up. That's where I was at.
Oh, man. So you guys, you know, you finished the season, 125 wins, greatest team of all time. And of course you get the parade. What was that like for you?
It was so cool. I mean, I was there with Dave Cohen and his dad. I think Hideki Arabu and George Rose was in our thing. And then I had my wife and my son, Brandon, just to go through, you know, that parade with your kid was, you know, it was a very special time. And I've already been in one parade before, but it was nothing like the New York parade.
No.
And to me, and I remember someone threw a roll of toilet paper. It came from, I don't know what floor of what building, and it landed in our float, and Brandon picked it up and he heaved it out and it hit some dude right in the forehead. Cody and I started laughing our asses off. It was pretty funny, but you know, to get that experience and see the love of the New Yorkers, you know, going through that, that was pretty intense. That was pretty awesome to be a part of.
Well, Boomer, you'll always be remembered in New York. As you know, you're part of history there. I really appreciate you taking the time to go over some memories.
Hey, we got no baseball and I'm bored. So if you need some more, let me know.
Before we get to the bleacher tweets, I want to mention today's episode of ESPN Daily. Jeff Passan talks to an Italian MLB baseball scout who shares insights from the center of the pandemic and the unlikely story of how he came to love the game. That's ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcast. Additionally, Jeff is going to continue telling stories about coronavirus through the lens of baseball on ESPN Daily. So today, we'll give you a little taste, dropping this episode in our feed. We hope you enjoy it.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. P.K. Steinberg up first with Chris Sale having Tommy John surgery. Do the White Sox win that trade even though the Red Sox won a World Series?
P.K. always brings great questions. I think this is a case where both teams won the trade, right? The Red Sox got exactly what they wanted. They spent a lot of money, they spent a lot of resources, and they made their team better for 2018, and they won a World Series. You're not going to ever second-guess that. And on the White Sox side, they've got some really talented young players that they're going to build on going forward. So I think it actually worked out well for both.
Yeah, that's the best kind of trade. Two winners. Moulton Ballsworth at GoJones71 writes in, do you think the lack of baseball and presumably the joy that fans will feel when it returns to action will benefit the Astros in terms of not hearing as many boos and trash talk and trash can banging? And we talked about yesterday, you know, the draft picks, I'm sure those will still be taken away, but could this be an unintended side effect of delaying the season because of coronavirus?
Moulton, you are 100% right, I believe. I think that the reaction to the Astros is absolutely going to be blunted, regardless of whether they start in May or June or July, or if we don't play baseball till next year. I just don't think there's going to be the same angst, because there are other things that have happened that seem a lot more important. You know, in fact, I had someone in the game say to me yesterday that the Astros players, and this is something they would never want or ask for, kind of caught a break with how this is all playing out, that the reaction to them is not going to be as strong as we thought it was going to be.
Austin LeClaire writes in at Big Red 1044. What destinations are on your bucket list nationally and internationally once these travel bans have been lifted and we're all allowed to leave our houses?
Yeah, so this is 100% true story. I have a trip scheduled, the plane tickets bought, to go to Nepal.
Wow.
On December 27th, because I've always wanted to see Mount Everest. I've seen all 50 states here. Mount Everest is the number one at the top of my bucket list. And of course, who knows what's going to happen. As we sit here today, though, that's still the plan. Fly on December 27th.
I will follow up with my wife and I. We have tickets to Italy purchased for August. Wow. So I don't really know if that's going to happen. We were going to go to London and Portugal before that. So that is all very much up in the air. But we love Europe. So whenever, you know, this is all put to bed, we will assuredly go there, you know, if that's this summer or next spring, whatever. We're going no matter what. We'll be back. Yeah.
One more on that. I just feel so terrible. My wife's best friend, her wedding is planned for June in Italy.
Oh,
and we haven't gotten anything official, but obviously just you just feel terrible for people on so many different levels about what's going on.
I know it's interesting. You know, I'm like, oh man, I can't leave my house. I can't hang out with my friends. Like, people have had major life events on hold or completely canceled that they'll never get back. So it's a wild time, Buster. Kevin Millar Mallory Music at Kevin Mallory TX writes in, bro, The Sandlot easily top five. I mean, I understand why you wouldn't put it on. There's lots of great baseball movies, but as Boog Chambi pointed out, that was a glaring omission that many Bleacher tweeters wrote in about.
Yeah, and so we taped that at about 9:15 yesterday, 9:15 Eastern time in the morning. I did a radio hit on a show in Vancouver in the afternoon, and I got asked about that. And it was the same sort of reaction, like, what? No, Sam, what are you talking about? So again, I can't, I have no excuses. Okay. I just have no excuses.
It's fine. It's fine. I think the Sandlot is fine. I know a lot of people have, you know, hold in high regard, but whatever. It's okay. To each their own, Buster. Don't let them get you down. Last one for today, Brian at Brian Van Every. As a Rangers fan of more than 25 years, I remember very well the 2011 World Series. Listening to that David Fries interview was brutal, but I thought he was great and couldn't turn it off. And I think that is the reaction from most folks who listened to that interview. Great interview all around.
Yeah, David did a great job with that. You know, and I thought about that. I mean, David is a really, as you heard in the interview, he's very fun. He's got a great laugh. Other players really like him. And, you know, I thought about those 11 Rangers. The manager of that team was Ron Washington, who is another of baseball's great storytellers. We're going to have him on at some point on the podcast as we go in the storytelling mode now to tell his side of that. And remember, Ron Washington has been a third base coach for so many years. So you know that there have been games when David Fries was playing third base and Ron Washington was a third base coach. And I guarantee you it popped up in some form or fashion, right? Oh, or maybe it didn't. We'll have to wait for Wash to tell us about that. And by the way, we're both very excited because we're going to get a chance, speaking of storytelling, to talk with Dave Roberts, the manager of the Dodgers, who's going to join us to talk about the incredible comeback of the Boston Red Sox in the 2004 American League Championship Series. Dave's stolen base was right in the middle of that in terms of pivotal moments. And we're going to be asking about all that over the weekend. And you guys will hear that on Monday's podcast. That's it for today. My thanks to David Wells and to Taylor Schwenk. Have a great day, everybody. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.